You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And hey everyone, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today to discuss our February 2026 book club pick, Behind Frenemy Lines by Zen Cho. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon supporter, you can gain access to our members-only Discord server. You can chat with us and fellow book club members about all sorts of topics, including our monthly book club picks in real time. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a quarterly book club pick. And our next patron's choice is actually coming up for our April pick. So if you join now, you can be a part of the process of picking our next book club pick. But yeah, Rira, we made it to the end of February. How are you feeling? I know I always ask you this, and it's
you do always ask me this.
But you know, personally, how are you doing?
I guess I'm doing okay. I mean, I thought I would be kind of in an Olympic, like post Olympics depression, but I don't know. Like, I'm kind of glad that I could go back to like my normal sleep and waking up schedule. I'm glad that I have a couple more weeks until the world's figure skating tournament starts. I've been getting a lot of figure skating edits in my algorithm because now, since like Alyssa Liu won gold, everybody's into figure skating now. So I'm seeing a lot of fan art. I'm seeing a lot of edits. I'm seeing a lot of adults take adult skating classes. I'm like, oh, this is great. I hope you guys stick around for
it's been fun watching everyone worlds. Discover that both Alyssa and Amber Glenn are like huge nerds.
Okay, here's the thing about figure skating. Figure skaters are theater kids on ice. They're theater kids, or they're like anime fans, or they're like straight up nerds, like with mathematics or physics degrees. Like sometimes they're all three, but they are all nerds to varying levels. Alyssa is a big anime fan, like a big anime fan.
I mean, I believe that understanding centrifugal force and the physics of motion probably plays a lot into becoming a top tier figure skater where you have to spin real fast.
Yeah, it's like crazy because a lot of the Asian American skaters who, you know, went on to the Olympics, you know, they went to Ivy League colleges and they actually attend all of their classes. They submit all of their homework on time. I feel like to be an Olympian, you have to be an overachiever. So I'm always like really surprised that these kids have, because they're kids, they're way younger than me. It's like they have more going on than just their Olympic career. Because training is so much work. You're training on ice and off ice. It's if you guys have Netflix, please watch the documentary Glitter and Gold with the ice dancing teams, because it kind of shows you like how much training you have to do to be an Olympic skater, even a skater that doesn't do jumps like in ice dancing. And it's just like, wow, what was I doing when I was their age? Nothing.
I was doing all the nerdy stuff without the figure skating, for sure.
It's like, how can you be smart and freaking athletic? That is that is a combo that I'm like so baffled at.
You know, having money, having parents with money also probably helps there, you know.
I mean, yeah, figure skating is an elite sport. It does cost a lot of money, especially in America where it's not state sanctioned, but still, like, it's not like I came from a poor family. Like, I definitely had a lot of resources growing up, but I did not grow up even a quarter dedicated or talented as these figure skaters. So, yeah, that's been just on my mind lately.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I probably should have. I didn't realize it was the Olympics in February until it, like, they started. Like, it kind of snuck up on me this year. But if I had known ahead of time, I might have chosen the figure skating book for this month's book club pick. Although I do not regret choosing Behind Friendly Lines. I had a lot of fun reading it as well.
You know, this is our second book of 2026, but it's also our second British author that we're reading this year. Because Reef was written by Ramesh Gunasekara, who is a Sri Lankan-born British author.
Yeah.
And Zen Cho is a British author of Malaysian descent.
One might say we are in a very Asian-British time of our life.
Asian-British time. So, like, when we do our intro, we're like Asian and Asian-American. We mean, like, Asian diaspora in general.
I feel like we should probably switch up our intro to be more inclusive. But
I mean, sorry. But it's like very funny. Like, we'll announce our March book club pick, but it's also not an American author. So we have read zero Asian American authors for book club.
That's why I say Asian and Asian American, kind of just covering all our bases, right? So, you know, we're fine. We're fine. The intro is fine as is, because we built it into our log line for sure. But
yeah,
we are here to discuss our February book club pick. As always, we do discuss the book in its entirety in our book club discussions, which includes all plot twists and character details. So if you do care about being spoiled about that stuff, this is your cue to hit pause and finish the book before coming back listening to the rest of our discussion. Although we are reading a romantic comedy, so I don't know if there's much to spoil besides like kind of little interesting twists and turns here and there. But yeah, if you've already finished the book or you don't mind being spoiled on some elements, feel free to keep listening. But yeah, let's get started. Rira, can you start us off, as always, with the book description of Behind Frenemy Lines?
Charles Goh has always played by the rules. It's how he survived his difficult childhood as a swafty foreigner at the posh English boarding school, and now his high-pressure job at one of the biggest corporate law firms in London. His job is his life, and he's happy that way, until she shows up. Kriya Rajasekhar's lost her way. Her longtime boyfriend's broken up with her, and she feels trapped in her legal career. She knows she needs a fresh start, but it turns out her new job is at the same firm as her work nemesis, Charles Goh. He is like a bad luck charm she keeps running into, and their encounters lead to disaster every single time. And now, he's her office mate. But just as they're figuring out how to navigate this frenemy relationship, Kriya needs Charles' help. Pretend they're dating so her boss will stop hitting on her. Soon it becomes less clear whether they're enemies, friends, or something else.
Yeah.
So this book was originally pitched as enemies to lovers, but I think the marketing team and the bookstagrammers figured out, oh, that's not a correct term for it. So they pivoted to rivals to lovers.
Yeah, I was going to ask about, this was the first thing I wanted to discuss too, because I was thinking about rivals to lovers, and I don't even know if that encompasses what this is, because they're not exactly rivals in work. They're not after the same like jobs or promotions or things like that, right? Like they're just like, they're, is it nemesis to lovers? But also like nemesis in the case of this book is also used very broadly. Like he's more of like an albatross to her, but like they don't actively foil each other, right?
Yeah. Okay. So like I highlighted a passage that Kriya says in her POV. Work nemesis, though to be fair, I was the only one who'd characterized our relationship that way. Before I turned up at his office, Charles had apparently thought of me as that girl who drafted the witness statement for Macintosh cereals. So even she's just like, this was all in my head. He is not my nemesis. Like,
yeah.
I mean, their first meeting is she's going to an interview with his law firm. And she's having like a bad start. She trips and he doesn't help her. He was being kind of dickish about it.
Right. This is the 10 years ago prologue, right? About like
13 years ago, actually.
13. OK, yeah. It was like right. It was her first job interview after college, right? Or law school.
Yeah, because she was going for a trainee contract.
Right.
So I'm guessing that's like an intern. In British terms.
Yeah,
learned a lot of British slangs through reading this book.
That's true. But yeah, like I was just, what would you classify this romance as? Like, I think it's, I mean,
honestly, they should have just pitched it as workplace romance.
Yeah, right.
Like, I feel like that is the most accurate term for it, because even though this is a slow burn, I feel like you jump in pretty quickly into like, oh, they're really into each other.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like there isn't that much time where Kriya is like really begrudging on like working with Charles, and she doesn't actually work with him. They just share an office space. So it's just like, okay, like forced proximity, I guess. There's only one bed, but the bed is an office in this regard.
And I understand like the ex to lovers, like marketing is shorthand to help people kind of get a sense of what the relationship is like, but they're never really like competing for anything together. If anything,
yeah, like I thought before I like read the synopsis for the book, I was like, okay, it's like rivals, enemies to lovers, like work nemesis. Like, there are two Asian lawyers at the same firm. Maybe they're competing to be a partner. Like, that was kind of like the vibe I was getting, but it was clearly not that.
Yeah.
So.
Not that it detracted from the fun of the book. The book was still a lot of fun, but like I was just like, I was expecting more rivalry, I guess. But you know, I'm not mad about what we got, because what we got was like a fun rom-com as well. And I think, you know, this is our second Zencho book, but our first contemporary story from her. And I think a lot of things I loved about Sorcerer to the Crown is still on display here. Like, Zen has a really amazing ability to write fully fleshed out characters with like histories and motivations. And I really loved the time that we spent with both Kriya and with Charles as well as their friends and family.
Yeah, I think in terms of like British romance authors, I'm not in that scene, so I don't really know what's popular, but I can just assume that they don't really have a lot of Asian leads in their romance novel. So it is really nice that not only we get like a Malaysian female protagonist, but it's like a Malaysian of Indian descent. So it's like a different like it's part of the Malaysian diaspora, but like an underrepresented demographic.
And Kriya also makes mention that being like of Desi descent in Malaysia puts you at the bottom of like their societal ladder, right? Below the Malays and below the Chinese.
And, you know, Charles is from Hong Kong, and at first glance, it seems like he is like one of those posh kids who got to go to boarding school, has all the right friends, and has benefited from like the old school boy network. But we find out quickly that's not the case. His dad is kind of a wastrel, and Kriya and Charles have like the same responsibility as kind of like the eldest only child.
Caretaker,
I don't know if they have siblings. They're only children, right? I know Kriya's an only child.
Well, Charles has two half siblings from his dad's second marriage. Okay. Yeah.
So pretty much only children who are the breadwinners and who are taking care of their parents. And that dynamic is kind of not the norm in like Eastern culture, I would say.
I mean,
like,
yes,
you take care of your parents when you're older, but like, it seems like they were always taking care of their parents, even when they were younger.
I mean, it's a combination of like Eastern filial piety and also like the what's the term of like the family member who leaves home to like go make money and send them back, like remittance, I think is what it's called. There's some of that going on. I really do love it. And there's something else that like I keyed in on, which is like, you know, both this book and both the main characters of Behind Friendly Lines, as well as Sorcerer to the Crown, are people who grew up under, like, you know, in Sorcerer to the Crown, people who grew up under the oppression of like imperialism and colonialism. And in this book, both Charles and Kriya are people who grew up under the environments of like post-colonial Hong Kong and Malaysia.
Yeah.
And so those aspects are still like, they're very much a part of their character and a part of like their family's history.
I kind of think that Kriya and Charles, they like trauma bonded. That's like, because the reason why like they I feel like a really big turning point was when Charles invites Kriya to his cousin Loretta's wedding. And it's like, yeah, you get it, because you come from an Asian family. You know how nosy the aunties are. And yeah, it's just like, okay, yeah, like, it's not the first. I think at one point she says, it's not the first time that I've been to a stranger's wedding. I'm Asian. And it's like, yeah, that's so true. How many strangers' weddings we've gone to because we have to like save face or whatever.
Yeah, I did really enjoy all the rom-com set pieces in this book. You know, Loretta's wedding being one, the Nasi Lemak party being one. Did you, I know we're jumping ahead, but did you enjoy the cosplay wedding that they went to?
I did. And I kept thinking, why did none of my anime geek friends have like a cool wedding? They all buckled to the pressures of I need to have a normal normal wedding, because I don't want, like, my family is paying for my wedding and I can't do all the cool shit. Or they're like, well, I go to conventions all the time, so, you know, I want to have a normal wedding. But I, as an attendee, is like, I want to go to a cool wedding. Like, I want to cosplay.
Yeah. I want to. I did love. Did you clock that the Duke of Badminton that they're big fans of is just Prince of Tennis, but like in this.
Oh, yeah. I immediately clocked it as Prince of Tennis because that was one of my hyperfixations when I was like in high school. But then I kind of doubted myself for a second, because I was like, I've been out of the anime game for so long. Maybe there is a badminton anime. So I checked, and there is a badminton anime, but it's with like a girls team. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
I think Duke of is just like a giveaway. Okay, this is Prince of Tennis. And I did enjoy the parts where Charles is like, yeah, I mean, they really love it, but the anime kind of sucks. It makes no sense. But, you know, he seems pretty cool about like just like playing along.
Yeah, he kind of has the same vibes as it's been so long since I've watched Prince of Tennis. The only characters I know are like Echizen and Tezuka, but he's like the data nerd in the team. There is a character in the Prince of Tennis team where he wears glasses, he has black hair, and he's just like, oh, I have studied all of your techniques and I know all of the probabilities of like you making this attack rather than this move. So I'm like, oh, that's him. But I'm pretty sure he wasn't dressed up as that character because he's not the hot one of the bunch. So
yeah,
I don't know, maybe he dressed up like Tezuka. I guess that's like the closest. He wears spectacles too.
Yeah, whoever the equivalent is in the Duke of Tennis universe, that's probably who he was. And I guess speaking of Charles and his data focused nature, I want to get your opinion on, you know, so this book is written in two POVs. We have Kriya's point of view and we have Charles's point of view. And Charles's chapters are written kind of more like in a stream of consciousness type of prose, right? It's very,
I wouldn't say it's stream of consciousness. I would say it's more like a deposition in a way.
Yeah.
It's like written in like playwriting format also, because the dialogue's all with a colon and not with a comma. There's no description. It's just pure like text, no, sometimes like no context whatsoever on like what's happening in the scene. And as a reader, like when you're reading his POVs, you're like, what is happening? It feels like you're like hitting against a wall. You're like, I understand like what people are saying, but I feel like I'm missing a lot of the context of what their tone is like, or like what the situation is like. Because he kind of reads as someone who, I don't want to like diagnose people, but it sounds like he's autistic, like, or he has very bad like social awareness, whereas Kriya's chapters, it's like much warmer. There's a lot more context. She's like more personable. And it's only through Kriya's chapters where I'm like, okay, I can see the appeal of Charles. Because reading from his POV, I'm like, this guy, I would not go for him.
I think it's definitely an interesting way to portray. And I think, I don't want to, again, like you said, we don't want to diagnose anyone without, like, you know, because it's never confirmed whether or not he is neurodivergent, but it is kind of, he does have like I guess, markers, and the way that he approaches the world does seem very like, he does have trouble reading social cues. He does have trouble reading tone, and he likes things spelled out for him. He likes rules, right? So there's a lot of markers. And I thought his chapter's a really interesting way to get into, like, when we see him through Kriya's point of view, it's through, like, she's processing what he's saying, but sometimes she can also read in between the lines. But, like, in his chapters, we get a sense of, like, how he processes things and how he, like, approaches different situations, right? Like, the reasons why he does what he does through, like, his, like, thought process.
Yeah, and that's what makes his relationship with his cousin, Loretta, like, really endearing to me, because Loretta is the one who's like, you're an idiot. Like, there's, like, one point in the book where she's like, you did that thing where you're rude to girls that you like. You know that this doesn't work in real life, right? You're pretty much Mr. Darcy, but Mr. Darcy without the lake. And I'm like, that's a pretty accurate statement on, like, you're really standoffish. You kind of give off this feeling of, I know more than you, so therefore I am superior than you. But you don't really have, like,
yeah,
that swoon moment, I guess that's what she's saying. But I thought I kind of, like, cackled a little, because I'm like, oh, you know, the 1995 Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah,
lake scene is so infamous.
But he kind of does, right? Because the first moment that Kriya sees Charles in that, like, 13 years ago scene, she is swooning, right? She's like, oh, man, this guy is really hot. Right?
Oh, yeah. I highlighted the passage. So she says, he's not beautiful like a K-pop idol, more like an Asian American actor who starts out playing the scene, stealing comic relief in a quirky sitcom. Then all of a sudden, he's a sex symbol and cast as the lead in This One's for the Chinese Market installment in a huge Hollywood franchise. And I'm like, are we talking about Manny Jacinto?
I was also thinking Manny Jacinto. Yes. Yes.
It's like, I love how, like, we just, like, clocked it immediately.
I feel like that's his, like, you know, you start off as a goofy guy in a good place, and all of a sudden you're hot Sith guy. You're hot Jedi.
He's always been hot. He's always been super attractive. But yeah, like, I listened to this book on audiobook for, like, maybe, like, half of the book. I, like, went on and off. It depended on, like, what I was doing at home. Sometimes I had to, like, put down the book and I had to, like, listen to it. But she says at one point, or, like, in the beginning, she says, oh, he has the hottest British accent I've ever heard. And I've been living in London for quite a while, and that effect, like, wears off. And the male narrator for the audiobook, I'm sorry, he doesn't have it. It did not do it for me. I was like, this guy? Like, and it doesn't help that his POV chapters are like him, like, reading a deposition, like, so, like,
yeah,
cold and, like, straightforward. I'm like, oh, man, like, I wish I could have had that swoony, hot British accent, but I didn't get it.
Right. I listened to this book mostly on audiobook as well, because, you know, childcare necessities. But thinking back, I do agree. Like, it was a pretty, like, for lack of a better word, basic British guy reading it. Whereas I feel like what we're looking for,
I mean,
is
he didn't,
like,
maybe sound, like, posh, in my opinion.
Yeah.
He was like, no posts on Sundays. Like, very, like, like, very, like, Mr. Dursley from Harry,
like,
Potter.
Who would you dream cast as, like, the voice of Charles? Like, who has the best, like, sexy British accent?
I mean, I'm sorry, he's white, because I don't know a lot of Asian British guys. I'm sorry, but immediately I was like, oh, where's Ben Barnes? Like, he has the best British, or, like, Tom Hiddleston, my two British white boys, where I'm like,
yeah,
I mean, they're very charming voice-wise.
I mean, Henry Golding has, like, a posh British accent, right?
I guess, yeah, he does, like, in Crazy Rich Asians. Yeah. That's the only thing I've seen of him. Unfortunately, I did not see his other works, so
well,
I don't
know.
In
that, it's not a murder mystery, but the one with Blake Lively and
oh no, it was with Blake Lively. Okay.
Yeah, forgot what it was called, but he was pretty good in that one too. But yeah, I can see that. I mean, and I get it, like, you know, casting for audiobooks is hard, especially these days when we're also looking for authenticity. We're looking for like Asian voices, voicing Asian characters. And so sometimes you got to work with what you have. But yeah,
it would have been better for the immersion. But I feel like they're out there, though.
Yeah.
Like you definitely can find like a Hong Kong, like British boy who probably has a posh accent, because those are the people who could afford education abroad. So I'm like,
yeah, especially since Korea had a pretty good like Malay accent, right, in her chapter.
But anyway, Kriya moves to this new law firm because her boss Arthur, he's moving, and she's like, well, he's my— not only is he my mentor, but like I've pretty much only worked with him in the last like 10 something years I've worked at this company. And
red—
I was like,
flags—
that's a little
immediately
weird. That's a little—
right.
I was like, that's a little sus. And her being like, if he leaves and I stay, then all of my clients are going to go to him because he's the senior. And I'm like, okay, that— not a great place to be in terms of like
also,
working for—
also law. Not a great work relationship. And the fact that like as we read the book, we realize actually the clients seem to like her better than Arthur, especially the ones that like deal with her directly.
Yeah. And it seems like he's really clueless as well. He keeps like asking her to do like basic things like, OK, can you like build the slides? Can you give me all the notes? And I'm like, shouldn't you be doing that as the person who's going to be presenting? That's kind of weird. And there's a scene where Charles is talking to Loretta, and she's like, oh, the hot lawyer is in your office. Like, what is she like? And he's like, well, I mean, she's a really good lawyer, but her boss is kind of weird. And, you know, she's like the typical typical great woman behind a mediocre man who's like doing all of the work and he's getting all the credit. And I'm like, yeah, I'm glad that at least he was able to clock that immediately. But I guess like if anything, Charles would clock that because he's all about work, all about ethics, all about, you know, the—
I mean,
rules.
To be fair, all of Priya's friends also clocked it, as well as everyone who's ever worked with her. I feel like it's your classic like toxic relationship, like toxic boyfriend, that like everyone can see that it's not working out except for you because you're too deep in it and you're too like, I've invested too much time for this to not work. Kind of in parallel to her relationship with Tom, her ex-boyfriend, right? Like they're kind of just in a relationship, and even though it's not working, she can't bear to end it because she's already sunk like at that point, like 12, 13 years into it, right?
Yeah. So she started dating him at like 22, I think. So 13 years. So she is like, what, 35 in this book,
mm-hmm.
for the most part.
Yeah.
Which tracks as like someone who is a senior at a law firm. But yeah, like when she was talking about Tom, she's like, oh yeah, like I paid for rent. He didn't have a job. And eventually, like he got a job, but it was overseas, and he was like super excited about it. And then he just like left because that was like, you know, something worth chasing rather than staying for. And I was like, girl, you've been paying his rent and like been—
yeah.
Like cooking for him, like doing everything for him for how many years?
And I guess you can kind of see that as like generational trauma manifests in different ways, right? And she is someone who's always, like we said, she's been a caretaker, like she's been a provider for her parents, for her family, and apparently for her boyfriend and for her boss. Like that's just kind of how she is wired. And it's no surprise that she finds herself in like a lot of situations. Her coming of age in the story is kind of deciding that she needs to put herself first, right? And that's really hard when you're like firstborn daughter of like an Asian family.
Yeah. So she and Arthur go to Hong Kong to meet a client.
Ooh, yeah.
And this is an inciting incident because Arthur, who had recently divorced, and it was a pretty nasty divorce, he is making moves on Kriya. And Kriya at first is just like, oh, well, this is just him being like professional. But then he would suddenly push the envelope and she's like, I would rather we focus on work. And then he'd be like, oh, OK, sorry. And then he'll immediately back off. And she's like, OK, everything is like normal. But then he like randomly showed up at her hotel room and he was like, hey, just so you know, I think I have feelings for you. You've like, I've never like had anyone who got me like you did. And she's like, OK, I have a boyfriend. So can you like please back off? She uses the classic excuse of I have a man, so you can't have me. Please leave me alone.
That whole chapter was like
ick.
It was tense and icky, right? Because you can see her like clue in on what he's trying to do and actively rationalize that that couldn't possibly be it. I know this person, like this person would not do this, until he literally shows up at her hotel room to shoot his shot. And I think, at like, that point, like she couldn't rationalize anymore.
The audacity of him throwing, like shooting his shot was just like, you're old enough to be her dad. You've mentored her. And like, you know that she's gone through a bad breakup and you're going to shoot your shot now. And you're her, like you as a lawyer should know like power dynamics and how this is not okay.
Well, she's also his direct subordinate. He, like her, like, you know, we have a lot of classic power dynamic things at play here, right? It's like similar to like, you know, yesterday was Bridgerton Day, Bridgerton Part 2, it came out. And, you know, this season's all about power dynamics between Sophie and Benedict as well, right? So, which is like, here is someone who is kind of financially dependent on you keeping your shit together and keeping your relationship professional. And so even if you say, oh, we are equals in this relationship, you are not, because you still have her economic future in the palm of your hands, essentially.
Yeah. And like that, like after she manages to get him out of like her hotel room, she like locks the door with like the chain across the bar and everything. Like she double locks her door. And I was like, man, I've done that before. Like, I hate the fact that women have to deal with this, you know, like even people that you have known for years, they can switch things up on you. And it's like, okay, let's make sure they don't break into my room and possibly assault me. Like,
yeah,
that is something that you have to think about. And it's like, okay, why? Like, it sucks.
And he does pull the classic, like, manipulative, toxic man shit, which is like, well, you shouldn't have been so familiar with me then if you didn't want my attention like this, right? Like, he does push a lot of the blame to her.
As if he didn't monopolize her and, like, refused to share her with other partners, made sure he didn't use any other trainees. Like, he groomed her. And that's just such an icky feeling when you think about, like when we think about grooming, we think about young children, right? But it can happen when you're a young adult as well. Because, like, she's also in a very vulnerable spot as someone who needs a visa to continue working. So that's another layer to the power dynamic.
Yeah. But this confrontation does lead to her basically using Charles as like cover, right? Charles becomes her fake boyfriend because Arthur again makes an assumption when he tries to confront her, tries to talk to her about what happened in the office.
I was so uncomfortable to read. I was just like, dude, what are you doing?
Yeah. Just flexing the power that he has over her. Like,
but also just like him being so, like him assuming so much from just a small like interaction. Cause like what happened was Charles gives Kriya like some cookies or whatever.
Yeah,
and
meaning cookies.
He sees that and he's like, oh, that must be the boyfriend. And that must be why she didn't want to tell me, because it like is a workplace romance. And he fucking pulls Kriya aside and he's like, oh, so you should probably not be in the same office as him. There's like a weird, like, you know, you have to report workplace romances within a month of like starting the relationship. Like, you should have told me. And then she's just like, it's not him. And also, like, we don't directly work with each other. Like, I don't understand why this is a problem. And just him, it's a workplace retaliation because he's like, oh, well, you know, you should move out of your office that I contractually made sure that you would have. You should just work in a pod. And I'm like, dude, no. Like, why are you punishing her for absolutely nothing?
I mean, to be fair, if I saw two people who looked like rom-com leads here in office together, I would also assume that something was going on.
Yeah, but then you wouldn't like insert yourself in that, though. Yeah. It's just like, whatever. Like, they'll announce it when they announce it.
I'll just write fanfic in my head. That's all.
I'm sure like the entire workplace was thinking that, too. They're just like, oh, like two hot people sharing an office together who like clearly have chemistry. Yeah, they're definitely going to bone.
Yeah.
But it's not any of our business. We'll just watch as if it's a soap opera, which is the correct thing to do instead of being Arthur and being like, just making so many assumptions and making so many moves that are so unprofessional.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was just real ick.
But this misunderstanding leads to them entering a quote unquote fake relationship.
It's not really fake relationship stuff because like Creo's just like, oh, fine. Like, I have to like go look for a guy who can pretend to be my boyfriend so Arthur doesn't think that we're dating.
Yeah.
And Charles, who, you know, has the hots for her, he's like, actually don't mind if it makes it easier for you to just, you know, don't have to announce it to anybody. He's already made the assumption you're not going to change his mind. And she's like, okay, yeah, sure.
He says that
while
he's obviously
fake date.
Yeah, he says that while he's obviously like sweating bullets underneath, like thinking, oh, this is a great opportunity for me, probably. But it does coincide with his need of a date for Loretta's wedding, right? Because
which was totally manufactured, by the way, because Loretta, like, Loretta has been pushing Charles to go after like Kriya, the hot lawyer that you keep running into, for a very long time. And she pretty much says, hey, so everyone thinks that I may have turned you gay because I'm a lesbian, so you need to show up with a date. Like, I mean, you can show up with like a guy as your date too. Like, who cares? But, you know, people are very curious about your love life. And he's just like, well, I'm not gay. I'm not asexual. And if the aunties are going to be nosy about this, then like, I guess I'll bring a date. And I think he knew in the back of his head that it was such a weak excuse. Like, no one would have fucking cared. He probably could have dealt with the strange stares and people being like, why isn't he with someone? Is he gay? Is he asexual? Like,
yeah,
he could have totally dealt with that.
Loretta, and by extension, Loretta's fiance / wife are agents of chaos, and I love them. They're some of my favorite characters in this book because they're just so, so joyful, right?
Yeah, I mean they are complete opposites to Charles. They really just go off the handles, you know?
It is funny when he was describing Loretta's partner as like someone who you wouldn't know is into all this like nerd shit just by looking at her, but like she's really into it. And that's kind of what makes it work.
I do love how Loretta has like all these collectibles in her room. And Charles, being like the sweet cousin he is, he's like, oh no, my apartment has a leak and my bedroom is completely destroyed. But what about Loretta? She's been collecting those figurines for so long. Like,
yeah, that was a great scene because she was like, don't worry about it. I'll just buy more. Good excuse
to buy
more. Yeah,
she was already in Japan for her honeymoon. And I'm just like, yeah.
Because, you know, for some people, it's not the collecting. It's the acquiring. That's the fun.
That's true. Yeah. But I would, like, for me, I would have been pretty upset because it's like I spent so much money on those collectible items and now they're gone.
Yeah.
It's like the memories that are attached to them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So the wedding itself is a major set piece in the middle of the book. This is when kind of their worlds collide, right? And I did really enjoy the chapter where they're in the family suite taking a picture. And then Kriya kind of gets ambushed by Laura's mom. And turns out she can speak Cantonese because she did grow up in Malaysia around Cantonese people. But also the fact that like she's able to get Charles to smolder by giving him a law question to think about. And everyone's like,
okay,
wow.
Okay. So like I was listening to the audiobook on the couch when that scene was happening. And Dan, my husband, was sitting next to me. And both of us kind of looked at each other around that part. And we're just like, wait, he's talking, though. So how is the photo going to turn out OK? Because if he's just rattling off all of these like legal stuff, how?
Well, I mean, photographers aren't just taking one picture. They're taking multiple pictures.
Yeah, but I don't know. I was like, the chances of there being like a good, sexy photo of him is very slim. So I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to trust the caliber of this photographer. But
I mean, if they're, yeah. I'm assuming they're, you know, they're professional cosplay photographers, and those people are pretty good, right? They're pretty good with their technique.
Not so much timing, I guess. But that was like something that bothered me and obviously bothered my husband. And we're like, oh, okay, well,
I thought it was cute.
Let's just say like it works because it shows that Kriya knows Charles better than anyone else. And because they're both lawyers, because they both work in very high pressure jobs, they get each other.
And it also shows that she has noticed that when he is deep in thought about a legal problem, he has a smolder.
I just feel like smolder is a wrong word for it, I think, in my opinion, because it's probably just being really concentrated. And I don't think you can describe both? That as a smolder, but whatever. Like, that's just like a tiny detail.
So another like rom-com set piece moment that happens during the wedding is Kriya runs into Loretta's wife, Haley's best friend from America. And then finds out that her date to the wedding is her new boyfriend, who turns out to be Tom.
Not new boyfriend, because she finds out that they've been together for like a year and a half. And she's like, a year and a half?
Yeah,
I was still dating Tom at that time. So he was definitely cheating on me. And you know, like he moved to America for this job and he was very distant. Like he just wasn't engaging in our relationship, and that's because he found like a side chick who now became the main chick. And
yeah,
it like the moment when Alexis like said, oh, we went to go visit this part of England, and she's like, oh, my ex is from that part of England, I was like, oh no.
Yeah,
red flag.
The crumbs were there. Like, I think all of us put it together. Yeah, I think the crumbs were there. Like, I think a lot of us put it together before the confrontation even happened, but it was definitely like a very messy moment in otherwise like pretty sweet few scenes, like sweet couple of scenes, right? And this leads to her running out and planning a kiss on Charles to like avoid seeing Tom. And this is something that some of our members talked about in Discord, which is like, what are your thoughts about like this kiss when compared to like Arthur's advances, right? Like both are unsolicited like advances, but I feel like in this case, like Charles didn't exactly not want it, right? I mean, does that change things?
I mean, she doesn't know that, though. That's the thing.
Yeah.
I have to reread that scene from Kriya's point of view to see if, you know, she picks up any cues that, you know, Charles is against this or he's being enthusiastic about it. I mean, enthusiastic in like quotation marks because it's Charles and he can be a robot sometimes. Yeah, in terms of consent, it's different for every single situation. And I mean, in this case, like Kriya and Charles, they are friends at this point. They kind of both know what's happening with Tom. I think Charles, with his lawyer brain, could kind of figure out why she was running away from him and what was happening. So I guess like he didn't show any hesitation when Kriya went to kiss him. However, it's still not okay, in my opinion. Not as big of an ick as Arthur, who knew that he was putting Kriya in a very like vulnerable spot. Whereas like with Charles, I'm like, if he really didn't want her to kiss him, I feel like there's Like, he could have easily made a signal saying no. Whereas with Kriya, it's like, that's her boss. She's in a different country. It's a hotel where there's no witnesses.
Yeah.
Much more dangerous situation.
Yeah. And I mean, at this point, we're like 2/3 of the way through the book. We're like actively rooting for these two dummies to love each other. Right. Like, because they're both obviously attracted to each other, but they're both also like unsure about the other person. Right. Because, you know, Charles is not good at expressing his feelings and emotions. And Kriya is definitely in her head about like her codependencies on everyone. Right. On like her own like issues and codependencies. I did like that, you know, Zen Cho's books also feature really, really great banter. And like a lot of the conversations between her and Charles were also really like a lot of the interactions between her and Charles were really fun to read. Like it, you can definitely see that. Like, I like that she portrayed Kriya as someone who is understanding of the ways that like she keys in on that Charles has like idiosyncrasies, right? He has his own way of processing things, and you know, it doesn't always kick in, but she does realize that like he has special ways that he views the world. I thought that was a really good way to like, because it would have been really easy to just make that be the basis of all their misunderstandings, but like the fact that she is also empathetic, I think, is played a huge role in like making their interactions really more sweet than like adversarial.
Yeah, I was actually pretty surprised after the kiss. They went to a coffee shop so that they could take a break from the wedding. And, you know, Kriya like opens up to Charles being like, oh, this, you know, this is kind of what happened with my ex-boyfriend. And, you know, it's understandable for Kriya to open up and be like emotional about it because she literally ran into an ex and found out that he cheated on her for a year and a half. But then Charles being like, OK, well, my dad went to jail and my mom and he left us a lot of debt. He put that on my mom. And, you know, she continuously defends him and keeps saying that I only have one husband. And, you know, it's. And I was just like, where are you going with this, Charles? Like, why are you like telling all these like details to Kriya? And then he says, well, I can understand why you're being defensive of Tom and, you know, blaming yourself for the sunk cost fallacy, because that's exactly what my mom does and did. So I'm like, OK, so Charles does have some empathy muscles where he's like, OK, I can understand why you're being self-deprecating and blaming yourself.
And I can also see that as a form of like, you know, like being reciprocal, right? Oh, you shared this vulnerable moment of yourself. Let me share a vulnerable moment of myself. And also gets off his chest, like something that's been bothering him for like at this point, a few chapters, which is when he left her with the bill after taking out the law students, right?
That was such a red flag. I'm like, Kriya, like I could not be you. I would totally just not talk to Charles after that. Cause it's like, because right, like it's like usually the senior pays the tab and he's the most senior, like he's been in that company longer than Kriya, even though they're in the same position. And also it's like, you're a lawyer, you're making how much? Like you have no dependent. Like, I mean, obviously she made assumptions because no one really knows what people's financial situations are like, but like what was it, like 90 quids? Like she's just like, you could definitely afford that. I definitely got the ick on that, and like I get it, but it just reminded me of all those stories of girls going on dates with guys who kind of, you know, try to get out of paying the check. I'm like, what are you doing? Like, no, don't do that.
I guess.
But there was a reason for it, and he finally got it off his chest. Yeah. So I'm like, okay, redemption.
I mean, it's like the first like rom-com misunderstanding, which is like Charles essentially like short circuits in that moment, right? Because he thinks about all the money he doesn't have because he's bailing on his dad, but he can't really say that to her. But he also has like RBF, right? And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know, red flag, but definitely like, oh, like, maybe our relationship isn't closer like I thought it was getting, right? Like to her, Charles has always been like this distant kind of cold figure who always looks like he's smelling something stinky. Like very much the first few chapters of like a Mr. Darcy relationship, right? In Pride and Prejudice, which is like just always just thinks like seems like he doesn't want to be around you because like he's who knows why, but he's just always looks like he's not having a good time.
I mean, it's funny that you mentioned like Mr. Darcy because it's kind of the opposite when you think about like the POVs, because like Kriya is, you know, she's very vivacious, like Lizzie, and she's just like, oh, like this guy definitely hates me, right? Because he's like being standoffish to me, whatever. And like with Charles, you know, he thinks that Kriya can't be into him at all. But Mr. Darcy is just like, oh no, this girl is really into me. Because why else would she not? She's like being so nice to me. First off, she's talking to me, and my family is so much richer than her. Like, why would she not think of me as a catch? So it's like kind of different in that, like, Mr. Darcy is like, oh, she's definitely into me. And Charles is like, there's no way she could be into me.
That's true. I mean, that is the key difference, right? And Charles is definitely someone who, like, he's very confident in what he does. He knows what he does well, but he has no, like, confidence in, like, his ability to relate to others, his ability to, like, he can't even fathom that Kriya might even be interested in him at all, right?
Okay, I have, like a small complaint, and this is just my personal taste, and I was complaining to my husband about this, and I was like, oh man, as a reader, I am not attracted to Charles at all. And it's not even the fact that it, like, he doesn't have a posh British accent, like the narrator. It's just the fact that, like, okay, I understand being driven at work and like making work your life, because, you know, I used to be like that. Now I've mellowed out quite a bit. But it's just like it's just work and then gym. And just games. And I'm just like, if you are a gym enthusiast, like, no offense to you guys, like, you know, I admire your discipline, and because I do not have that. But I'm like, I'm so tired of male romantic leads being like a gym bro who like works out and has like biceps and abs. I'm like, I know that is like the conventionally attractive thing, but it just gives me the ick, because I'm like, every guy that I've met who's like really obsessed with working out have just kind of been dicks. So it's really hard for me to like to think of Charles as, okay, like he's like the sensitive guy, but also he's like buff. It's just not, it doesn't do it for me.
I mean, you have to be buff. Like you have, Zen has to give a reason why he's just so swole, right?
But yeah, like a lot of women don't go for swole guys. Like it's like the opposite, because, you know, when it comes to podcasts and look maxing, guys are always talking about like, oh, you have to go to the gym every day, you can't skip leg day. And I'm like, those guys are not trying to impress women. They're just trying to impress other guys.
Yeah. I saw a great TikTok of someone complaining about like how he did everything he was told and he got like 40 DMs all from dudes.
So that's my little complaint. That's
right. That's your red flag. My kind of red flag that came up in the last third of the book is the interaction. So he ends up taking a case from an old school friend that he hates, Shabui. Which turns out to be kind of a PR intimidation campaign against for the Malaysian. Was it the finance minister or some minister in Malaysia against like a independent journalist trying to like do an expose on them? Right. And this is when, you know, this project has been what has brought Kriya and Charles together. You know, late nights, you know, all the montage, like here is like us spending a lot of time together working on something. But when she finds out that they are working for someone who is actively making life worse for her parents and her family, she balks at it. But then Charles is like, but he's our client. He's very rigid with the rules, right? He doesn't, I understand your personal feelings, but this is our job and we need to do our job. And the fact that he was so like rigid in like something that was morally like not even gray, like darker than gray, right?
Well, him being like, how does it directly affect you? And she's like, are you fucking kidding me? Like,
yeah.
He stole taxpayer money from like Malaysians. He stole my parents' money. And there's a reason why I had to go all the way to freaking England to get my education. And, you know, I became a lawyer not because I'm like super passionate about it, but because like of stability. And I wouldn't need the stability if, you know, the government in Malaysia was like not corrupt. So, yeah it does affect me.
That was when I was like, I don't know if I would be able to overcome that, no matter how hot my partner was, if they were like very that rigid in like rationalizing legal codes, like rationalizing things like that. And I get like for Charles, like he finds comfort in legal codes or legal codes, rules. They inform him on how to properly act. But if I was Korea, I'd be like, I don't know about this guy. Like that would be
also
like
I'm a little bit pissed off by his, you know, I'm just like, why are you helping this guy that you obviously don't like and don't have any, like you do not owe him. I guess he does owe him because his dad, but I'm just like, that was his dad, not him. And like when he's pitched the job, like there's like zero details. It's like, oh yeah, we're trying to take this article down and it's doing damage to my client. My client has to be anonymous for now because it's very sensitive. And I'm like, why would you pick up this case? There's like zero information. And and he kind of had a feeling that it was like a bad thing too, because I'm like, oh, it's show buoy. Like he's the type of person who would just do anything.
But he
ahead.
Immediately figures out how to get billable hours while also keeping, like, basically his stance is, if I don't know about it, then it's fine, right? If I don't know if there's direct wrongdoing or if I can like find a way to justify it with rules, then like, you know, we're just going through the motions. I'm bringing in money for the firm. Everyone wins. Like no one loses. I thought that was a little hard for me to get past, like someone who's able to like rationalize things, something like that so easily.
And it's like super like he's not hypocritical per se, because, you know, in that scene where he's at the bar with the other like trainees / interns, and like one of them asks like, hey, so you work for these big companies, usually like oil and big pharma, and they are not the good guys. Like, how the hell do you work for them and like still have like a conscience? And, you know, he brings up a good point, being like, well, everybody deserves representation. Otherwise, no one would be able to have a defendant in court. And it's like, yeah, but at the same time, this job was not assigned to you. You picked up this job. You chose to bring it to the firm. And that's what I'm not okay with.
Yeah. Also, just the bigger conversation of, and they don't really dive into it, like this book isn't really like exploring this, but like, should corporations be treated like people? I think that's a big, like, that's a big question we're asking ourselves these days too, in our modern that's a big question
especially after like the Paramount Warner Brothers thing that just happened.
But personally for me, I was really like, this is when I was mad at Charles, like, dude, you need to like look at it from her perspective. But you know, in terms of the story, this does lead us to the I guess what I've been referring to as the pretty woman incident, where he punches Shaw for like besmirching Korea's honor.
Mm-hmm.
Thereby acting on emotion for like the first time in the book.
I mean, because like Shaw Bowie's like he doesn't outright say it, but he's like, there was a leak and nobody else knew except for you and your assistant, and the assistant doesn't work at your firm anymore. Well, that's suspicious. I mean, I'm glad she's not working on this anymore, but you know, if she does something, then I know some powerful people. Like, that's that's blackmailing. That's literally a threat. But also he calls Korea very like derogative like names. And he tells Charles like, oh, I didn't know that you were a curry chaser. And I'm like, what? Like, dude, what?
Yeah. I mean, he deserved getting punched. No one was sad.
Yeah,
that
he definitely got punched. Yeah.
Yeah.
The fact that that's considered casual racism is like, I'm like, what? That is terrible. But Kriya actually leaves the firm because, you know, she goes into Arthur's office because she was taken off like a big case. And she's like, why was I taken off this big case? And he had just pretty much retaliated by giving it to somebody else. And he's like, oh, you don't have capacity. And he didn't want her to have high level connections. He wanted her to be continuously codependent on him.
Well, he gave it to a junior who she catches him also hitting on in his office, right?
No, that wasn't her. Like, he didn't give the job to her. He gave the job to somebody else in a different department, who was already swamped with work. So he was not doing his job. And she's just like, I have capacity. He doesn't have capacity. Why would you give my job over to him? And he had, like, when Kriya walks into his office, he is holding hands with Emily, and Emily looks like she would not want to be, she does not want to be there. She did not consent to this. She's very uncomfortable. And, Kriya, like, she just kind of snaps and she's like, okay, let me get her out of this office, make sure that she's okay. And then she confronts Arthur and she's like, hey, like, that was not okay. Like, that was a trainee. That was, like, totally unprofessional. And you know there's a power dynamic. And this is kind of what you did with me. And I don't appreciate it. And the whole conversation was just...
Yeah. I did like the fact that Arthur's comeuppance, his, like, ultimate fate was happened off screen. Because I don't think he deserved, like, the word count for us to read through it. But, like, this incident causes her to finally approach HR and also tender her resignation. She tenders her resignation on the spot, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, we find out later on that Arthur actually got fired.
Yeah, that's definitely, like, a optimistic turnout in real life situations where there is workplace harassment. However, Zen made it plausible because Arthur is a new recruit from a different firm. He hasn't had time to really build up a rapport. And it seemed like everyone in the office knew that he was, like, not a good lawyer. They were like, oh, it's his senior associate who is doing all the work. And they're actually more upset that she's leaving.
Yeah, it seemed like her at the old office, like, it seemed like their old law firm was also similar. Like, they were more upset that Kriya was leaving with Arthur than Arthur was leaving himself. But they also, like, there's a line, right, saying that there's a good chance that Arthur will probably land on his feet because he is a white dude in society. But the fact that he got, like, consequences was enough.
Yeah, but Kriya gets, she quits her job and she gets a job offer from one of her biggest clients who had been, like, very loyal to just her and not Arthur.
Yeah.
She gets a job to work as an in-house lawyer for a company that is headquartered in Hong Kong. And she's like, wow, this is great. Like, it's less pressure. It's closer to my parents in Malaysia. Like, I only stayed in England because of my shitty ex-boyfriend who is now, like, with somebody else. So there's really no point in me staying here. And Charles is like, but I'm here. Why do you have to leave?
I did love that they had one final rom-com miscommunication, which is, like, she asks him out for coffee before she leaves and he turns her down.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, Loretta, his cousin, is like, oh my gosh, she was totally asking you out. Like, why would you turn that down? You're an idiot. And then Haley reads the same message and she was like, I don't know. I could totally understand why Charles thinks it was like a networking thing because it's coffee. It's, you know, she could be asking all of her lawyer friends, hey, like, I need a job, or hey, like, I want to keep in contact with you. So, like, things work out. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, coffee's not really the best romantic way to have.
But at the same time, if like the girl of your dreams is like leaving and wants to meet up for one last time, you say yes, right? To like at least get some closure.
I don't know. I kind of blame Kriya on this one. I'm just like, girl, like if you want him, like if you want like a last moment with Charles, don't ask him out for coffee. Ask him out for dinner.
Or add some emojis, right? Add like a little heart or like a little face, like a happy face, like something to,
or like invite him to your apartment, to your flat, being like, hey, I'll make dinner for you. And it's like, oh, in her place, anything can happen in her place. That's how we ended up in a sexual relationship. Give some hint, girl.
But you know, in the end, it all works out because he also decides to transfer to the firm's office in Hong Kong, putting himself in closer proximity to his estranged father, who they also have one last conversation. I know a lot of our readers, a lot of our book club members did not enjoy the father, and he's written to be someone who you're actively like getting ick from also. Like he's also written as someone who like you're not supposed to like. This guy is like just like very narcissistic, very much like, well, you're my son, so you need to take care of me. Like, why aren't you taking care of your family? I did find it interesting that, like, in some ways, him and Charles are alike in that they're very rigid in their worldviews, even though their worldviews are completely different. But they're both, like, they both are very rigid in following the rules that they've set for themselves, right? Charles is very much into following the rules of law, the rules of policy. Charles's dad seems like he follows the rules of, like, for lack of a better term, Confucian patriarchy, filial piety, like very like Chinese, like relationship driven rules, right? Like societal rules.
Yeah, he's very entitled. The reason why he went to jail in the first place was because he was embezzling funds. And I'm like, ugh, what a common crime. And it was really painful to read his conversation with his dad. And I think it was like extra hard for me because I have friends who have like who have dads like Charles's dad who have like ruined the family's finances and does not take any accountability and actively makes things worse. And their children, like my friends, they feel responsible. And it's just really heartbreaking to see, you know, adult children try to, quote unquote, earn the love of their parents because it should be freely given without guilt. And unfortunately, a lot of parents who use Confucianism and patriarchy to their own advantage and twisting that to like get what they want, it's very common. So I was like, I know exactly what this type of person is. And and Charles like cuts him off finally. He's like, why would I give you all of my savings when clearly you keep adding to the debt? Because he thought the debt was like 50,000 pounds or whatever, and it turns out to be 1 million. And
yeah,
he's just like, why did you lie to my mom? And he's like, don't tell your mom. Like, you know how she stresses herself out with these things. And I'm like, you're the reason why she's stressed out. Like, fuck, just don't ever talk to this guy again.
Also, he takes a job from like Sha Bui's father to be like what is essentially going to be the fall guy for their future crimes. And Charles is like, why did you do that? And the dad was like, well, this is just how things work. This is how, like, you should be happy that I am providing, using this provider.
Quote unquote providing. And he's just like, oh, like old loyalties run deep. And I'm like, I don't think anybody would hire like a criminal and also someone who is like in their late 60s without any work experience. And it's like,
yeah,
I don't know, his grandiose idea of being above it all. And he deserves money and deserves respect when he hasn't done anything to earn it. I'm like, oh, I don't know. It's like a typical like firstborn emperor son, you know, syndrome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like they're told from a very young age that they're special and they're meant for greatness, and they just expect it to just come to them.
Which is why I'm glad that Charles is able to overcome his distaste for his father to be able to pursue the girl of his dreams.
Yeah. And he knows that, like, his dad, even though he cut off his dad, he's still going to hear from his dad. He's like, my mom's still in contact with him. She's still trying to help him out. I have half siblings that I still want to get to know. So obviously, I'm still connected to my dad in that way. But in terms of, like, having obligations to him, no more. I'm like, that's growth. It's yeah. growth. Let's get rid of that people-pleasing attitude. Unfortunately, filial piety is used as a weapon. And
yeah,
it was just very familiar.
It was good to see both of these characters kind of overcome some of their baggage. There's still baggage there. There's still obligations. They're both still very much enmeshed in their role as breadwinner for their families. But at least now they have each other and they've exercise themselves of like the most toxic elements of their lives for now.
Yeah
yeah.
I did think it was funny that one of Kriya's friend, I think her name was like Zuri, but she ends up being the connection to the lawyer who had been writing about the corrupt government officials from Malaysia, and she finds out that, you know, her, like, she finds out the connection to the journalist, and she's like, oh my God, this is the most exciting thing that's ever happened to me. And she's like, I'm in. And I'm like, that's a ride or die friend right there who's like, oh, government conspiracy, we're gonna uncover that, let's go.
We don't get a lot from Kriya's friend group, but the little that we do get is also much like Charles's family. It's like, it's just very, yeah. just some of the most fun scenes, right? Because just the controlled chaos of like a friend group that has been together since like middle school.
Them being like, Tom, we've hated him forever. And Kriya's just like, you've only met Charles for like 2 hours. Like, how can you say that, like, I should be with him, or I should, like, you know, consider him with like my new job in Hong Kong? And they're like, girl, have you seen, like, have you looked at a mirror? You guys are role playing as colleagues rather than role playing yeah. as boyfriend and girlfriend.
Have you seen yourself with him? Like, it's like everyone can see it but them. But I mean, that's what friends are for, right? These are also the friends that like hated Arthur for the longest time, but they couldn't yeah. get through to her.
The moral of the story is, listen to your friends. Your friends can suss out a bad vibe, so listen yeah. to your friends, believe them. I also a little small complaint, but you probably have the opposite opinion, Marvin, because now you're a parent, but her friend group was supposed to show up to her apartment for brunch. They show up at 9 a.m. And the excuse is, one of them is, you know, a mom of a baby. And she's like, oh, I need to put him down for a nap. So, yeah, we're having brunch at 9 a.m. And I was just like, no.
Okay, like, kudos for the friend
group. She did it last minute, too. I was yeah. just like, no, you need, like, over 48 hours to change the time to an earlier time.
Yeah, kudos to the friend group for accommodating their friend with a child. But as a parent of babies, like, I find myself, like, just saying, like I feel like it's not my place to impose on when people meet. I let people know, if you want me to be at this gathering, it has to be between this time and this time. So anything outside of the bounds of like lunchtime, essentially, I can't do, because we start nighttime routine at 5:30 p.m. So if I'm not home by 5:30 p.m., like we can't go out. So no, dinner's off the table, and usually breakfast is off the table too, because like it's kind of just hard to get them out the door that fast. 9 a.m. is kind of, that is a little sus. I feel like maybe because it's the city, maybe it's London, like they don't need to drive. They're probably just like taking the tube or something. So it's not as bad.
But it was like for a nap, though. It wasn't yeah. for like, a bedtime routine or anything. That's so true. I'm like, I understand that naps are a big deal, but you can also put your kid down for a nap at somebody's house. Like, it
you
takes
really
effort, but
can't.
It takes effort. I've seen babies do it. I've seen parents do it, but it was just like, okay, first off, way too early for brunch. Brunch is like 11 a.m. to like 1 p.m.
I mean, it's fine if they had discussed it ahead of time. If, like you mentioned, if it was like 48 hours, it was like a couple of days before, then like that's totally fine. Like you can have an early breakfast, an early brunch.
But it also takes place in Kriya's apartment and they didn't even double check with her. She didn't respond to any of their messages. So you should assume that it is not okay until the host says it's okay. So that was another thing where me as a type A person, I was like, this is not okay. This is like friendship, like breakup worthy, like
but
shenanigans.
It didn't seem like Kriya minded. And like, I feel like Kriya kind of was just going with the flow. Like, okay, you're here early. That's fine. Charles is the one that got like perturbed by it because he was expecting them to not be there that early. So I guess if it was me, I would be okay with it. I feel like my wife might be a little more, she's more type A as well. Like she's definitely more like, if you say this time you come at this time, I will be pissed. But yeah, I think for me, I'm probably more like Kriya, which is like, I wouldn't mind as much, like if, unless it was like, I specifically told you not to come at 9 a.m.
She didn't even say they could come at 9 a.m. That was another thing. But
I mean,
yeah,
some friend
like,
groups are just like that. Some friend groups are just, you know, they're very familiar and they're very like, they, you know, if you consider everyone like family, then, you know, that's the kind of interactions you get.
Nope, it's a nope for me.
Yeah,
if
obviously.
I invite you to come to my house to make brunch, and you come at 9 a.m. without confirmation from me, and you bring a baby, and you're like, "Sorry, I need to like leave early because I need to put my baby to sleep." I'm like, "Okay, then why didn't you just say you can't make it or come like after your baby is put on nap?" Because that would mean that it's actually lunchtime by that point or brunch time. Yeah, this is something that was bothering me a lot. And I was complaining to Dan about it for like for like a good half hour. And I was just like, oh, this friend group. OK, I can never be friends with these people. And it's OK. I can never be friends with these people. I am not attracted to Charles. This book is not it's not about me. It's OK.
Yeah,
it's not a self-insert story. It's I'm reading a story about two people that I have problems with fall in love. So,
yeah.
Curious to see what everybody else thinks about this book. And if you have read Sorcerer to the Crown, what are your thoughts on Zencho's writing?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed this book. Like I mentioned, I really love the way that Zencho writes her characters and imbues them with like realistic motivations, family histories, cultural histories, not only for themselves, but also for her side characters as well. And it was just a blast to hang out with everybody for these 300 plus pages. And to just root for Charles and Kriya to, you know, finally come to terms with what they feel for each other. Again, awesome that it's a romance between South Asian and East Asian characters. And yeah, like overall, it's a really enjoyable rom-com experience for me.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess with that, that'll do it for our discussion of Behind Frenemy Lines by Zencho. Like we were mentioned, if you have any thoughts about the book itself or about our conversation, please let us know either on our Goodreads forums or on our Discord. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts and feedback on our discussion whenever possible. But yeah, before we call it an episode, Rira, it's your month to pick a book club pick. So can you let us know what book we will be reading for the month of March?
Yeah, so my pick for March is Butter by Asako Yuzuki, translated by Polly Barton. And it is a Japanese bestseller and a literary thriller about a female gourmet cook and a serial killer, and the journalist intent on cracking her case. And it is supposedly inspired by a true story, so I will probably be doing a research on that because I love true crime. But this book has been on my TBR for quite a while. I've seen it featured at a lot of bookstores, like tables being like, oh, like thrilling new read. So it's been on my radar for a while. And yeah, like I said at the beginning of this podcast, not an Asian American author. we have not read a single Asian American author for this year so far. So,
and that's okay.
That's okay.
I love that it is not only a book about murder, but also a book about food. So something for me and something for you. I love that for us. But yeah, looking forward to checking out Butter with you over the month of March. And with that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you once again for joining us for a discussion of Behind Frenemy Lines by Zen Cho. And we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Ri Ryu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, I'm Phil Yu, and you may know me from a blog called Angry Asian Man.
And I'm Jeff Yang, author, journalist, and celebrity dad.
We host a podcast called They Call Us Bruce, an unfiltered conversation about what's happening in Asian America.
Each week or so, we host a discussion about some of the most vital and interesting topics in our pop culture and our community, bringing in guests who are shaping and informing this thing called Asian America from Hollywood to D.C. and beyond.
We've got media, entertainment, food, family, politics, representation,
the good, the bad, the WTF of it all.
So check us out wherever you get your podcasts or at theycallusbruce.com.
Peace.
Peace.
Hungry for spicy food and even hotter conversations? Craving community and authentic storytelling? Then join the table. This is Minor Legends, a new comedy fiction podcast supported by Potluck. Pull up every week with me, Angela Wong Carbone, and follow the stories of me and my friends as we serve up tasty tales of what it means to be Asian American at our weekly dinner hang. If you enjoy deep dishing on absurd stereotypes like tiger moms who tutor your dating game rather than grades, the insanity of your parents' immigration story, to the legend of that one good Asian cousin you can never live up to, then pull up a seat and grab a plate. Featuring dinner guests like Ronnie Chang, Brian Park, Usama Siddiqui, Celia Au, Perry Young, Supriya Ganesh, and more. It's a tasty rotation that'll leave you belly laughing and steeped in relatable and spicy conversations. Can you take the heat? Listen now for free wherever you get your podcasts.